they have a restraint, a constraint on their ankle. They're limited. They can't move. They're confined, so to speak. Or someone locked in a jail cell, that's confinement. They don't have freedom. Freedom is the absence of confinement and constraint. And just so you can see how deeply embedded this is in our modern world, this is from a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1994. They said this: the heart of liberty is to define one's own concept of existence, of the meaning of the universe. So do you see it in there? The absence of confinement, the absence of restraint. That's what freedom is. You need to be able to define your own concept of existence and of the meaning of the universe. And so, for example, people say, well, you know, it's like a child, right? When a child is living in their parents' house, the child has to follow the parents' rules. You know, they tell you when to get up in the morning. They tell you what you're going to eat. They're going to tell you if you got to go to school or if you got to go to work. It's just rules, rules, rules. Clean your room. Do the dishes. On and on it goes. I mean, it's brutal. It's bondage. All you poor kids living in your parents' houses right now. Do you realize that this is what your life is? But the day will come when you will move out, or they will kick you out. And you're on your own. And now you have all this freedom. You decide when you get up in the morning. You decide what you're going to have for breakfast. You want ketchup chips for breakfast? Go ahead, knock yourself out. There's nobody there to make you do anything. That, they say, is freedom. Children need rules. Adults don't. Children are confined. Adults are not, because children are immature. Adults, however, are mature. Now, notice, the idea here is that law is for immature, those who are immature. And you will hear this from non-Christians who will say, you know, Christians, they're not very psychologically mature individuals. They can't really think for themselves, so they need this book that's full of these laws that tells them how they are to live. Us secular people who define our own existence, who define what is right and wrong for ourselves, we're thinking people. We don't need these laws. We don't need these rules. But as we study this text, Psalm 119, 33 and following, as we study this text, I hope we're going to see two things. First of all, I hope we're going to see that in fact, actually, the modern understanding of what freedom actually is and what it means to be free is quite naive. Far more naive than the Bible's understanding of freedom. In fact, you could say that it's the one that is a little simplistic and a little bit immature, because freedom is far more complicated than simply saying the absence of constraint and the absence of confinement. That's the first thing. The second thing, hopefully, we're going to see is that the law of God is, in fact, liberating, not stifling. That freedom, true freedom as a human being, comes through conforming yourself to the law of God, not choosing your own law by which you're going to live. Now, I know that that's counterintuitive. That's probably a pretty outrageous statement to some of you. But hopefully we're going to see this true. First, this is true. First of all, let's deal with the first one. The modern view of freedom is naive. If you look in your text, you'll see in verse 36 and 37, interestingly, the psalmist says this. He says, turn my heart towards your statutes and not towards selfish gain. Turn my eyes from worthless things. Two times in two verses, the psalmist is pleading with God to do something. He's asking God to turn his heart away from something. He's asking God to turn his eyes away from something. Now let's begin with this first one. The first one is, turn my heart towards your statutes and not towards selfish gain. So the assumption is, the psalmist is saying, is that my heart is turned toward selfish gain. Now, we often don't think of our selfish gain as something outside of us. We think of selfish gain as our own desires, our own wants, and that's right. In other words, what the psalmist is saying is that my heart is turned inward on myself. The heart in the Bible is not the heart in modern parlance, right? We talk about the heart and say, oh, his heart fluttered when he saw the beautiful girl that he's in love with. You know, the heart is the seat of the emotions for human beings, and the mind is the seat of the intellect. In the Bible, no, the heart was much different. The heart was the center of the human being. It was the place of the will. It was the place that controlled everything. It controlled your desires, your intellect, all this kind of stuff. It was the center of who you were. And so what the psalmist is saying is that the heart, the center of this individual himself, is turned in on himself, on his own wants, on his own needs, on his own desires. He cannot see beyond the borders of his own self. And the amazing thing is this, is you don't control that. You don't control that. You think you do. You think you control your heart, but you don't. You think that you make all the decisions about what you love and what matters to you and what you're going to do, but you don't. You need your heart to be turned, according to the psalmist. Why is he crying out to God? Turn my heart towards your statutes. In other words, I can't do that myself. Here, the psalmist cannot control it. He's fixed on himself. He has no freedom from this self-centered life that he's living. It's the exact opposite of the modern understanding of freedom. According to the psalmist, selfish gain, being turned in on yourself, worrying about your own concerns, not caring about the needs and concerns of other people, but only what matters to you, that, he says, is bondage, not freedom. Now, what does that mean? Let's keep reading, and hopefully we'll find out. In verse 37, he says, turn my eyes away from worthless things. Very interesting, this word that's translated here, worthless things. In other places in the Bible, it's translated idol. Turn my eyes away from worthless idols, from worthless things. Again, asking God to do it because he cannot do it himself. Now, think about this with me for a second, okay? What is worship? Worship comes from an old English word called worth-ship. And to worship something is simply this. It's simply to say that something has supreme value, has supreme worth, has supreme meaning in your life. There is something that sits on the throne of every individual's heart that as long as they have that, things will be okay. If that thing is threatened or that thing is lost, they are driven into despair. We talk about this all the time. The human heart is an idol factory, John Calvin said. It's constantly setting its desire. Remember, the heart is the center of who you are, so it sets its desire, it sets its will, it sets its intellect, it sets its everything on something. And it places ultimate value and ultimate concern on that thing. We all do that. What we value most, what matters to us most, that is the thing that we worship. Okay? Even the secular person, all right? The secular person who is ruled by the idea that, you know what, I get to choose my own decisions, I have my own desires, I have freedom to define my own concept of existence and my own concept of the meaning of the universe. Even that person values more than anything else something, and the thing that they value more than anything else is that absolute freedom. They hate it when other people dare tell them what to do. They hate it when their freedom is threatened. But the irony of that is this: you cannot get away from worshiping something. You will desire something above all other things. So for example, let's say you grow up in a house where you have a father who is very, very controlling and very demanding and very overbearing, and his word can never be questioned, and he directs when you stand and when you sit, you know, just one of these overpowering men. And you grow up and you say, you know, I was nearly broken under the thumb of my father. It was stifling to live under that kind of draconian rule. And so when you grow up, you say, I'm not going to be like my father. And so when you have children, instead of being the father that the children need, you become the exact opposite. Because you grew up in a home where your dad was just so overbearing and overpowerful, you become the permissive dad. You become the dad who wants to be his kids' best friends. You become the dad who, when mom says, look, we got this problem, we gotta deal with this, we gotta put our foot down, you go, ah, it's just a stage, they'll get over it. And you have said, as you've left your father's home, you have said, well, now I'm living on my own, but you know what? You're controlled from afar because you're not doing what's right for your kids. You're not doing what's best for them as a parent. You are simply reacting to the controlling aspect of your father, and he's still ruling your life. Do you see? We cannot escape this. We all have to have something. Listen, the point is this. It is utterly naive to believe that freedom is simply the absence of confinement and of restraint. We are all constrained by whatever it is we worship. That's what the psalmist is saying here. He's pleading with God, turn my eyes away from worthless things, because those worthless things, those idols that I have set my eyes on, those things are ruling my heart. And nothing but the sovereign intervention of God himself through grace can peel me away from them. Now, it's also naive, however, to think that, well, the idea of having no rules is good. That's obviously foolishness. It's also naive to think that simply rules for rules' sake is good. You know, there are people, I'm kind of like this, I admit. People, you know, law and order people. We like rules. I know it doesn't look like I like rules. I look pretty free and easy. But I actually kind of like rules. I at least like routine. We think that life goes better with the rules. But you see, just having rules for rules' sake, the psalmist says, that's not a good thing either. In verse 33, he says, teach me, O Lord, to follow your decrees. Verse 34, give me understanding and I will keep your law and obey it with all my heart. In verse 35, he says, direct me in the path of your commands. In verse 39, he says, take away the disgrace I dread, for your laws are good. In other words, over and over and over again, he's emphasizing that he's not just seeking law, sort of some abstract law that he can hang his hat on and hook himself to and say, well, now I've got life figured out. No, no, no. There's a specific law he's after. He's after the law of God because, as he says in verse 39, your laws are good. They're good. Not all laws are good. Not all rules are good. You know, a musician, a student musician, they take up the violin, they take up the piano, they take up the guitar, even if they take up the drums. Doesn't matter what you take up. The student musician has to confine themselves. There are constraints. They have to sit there in front of their instrument on a beautiful sunny afternoon and play their scales. While all the other kids are outside running around, throwing the ball, swimming, doing fun stuff, they're constrained. They're limited. They don't have freedom. But those rules, what do eventually? When you master them, when you understand them, when you live by them, eventually what happens is you're released. You're released to play freely the music of Mozart or Bach or Chopin or John Lennon or whoever you want to play. You can play it. You have the freedom to play it. And the rest of us, poor slobs who are out playing ball, we stand there in front of the piano and all we can do is chopsticks. But what about the kid who at age 18 graduates from high school and says, you know, I want to be a linebacker in the NFL. And he's 5'8" and 120 pounds soaking wet. And he constrains himself. He goes to the gym and he pumps iron and he runs sprints and he does patterns and stuff like that in football practice. And then he goes out to the big tryout. And what happens to him? He gets utterly demolished. He constrained himself. But he wasn't freed to enjoy the glories of being an NFL linebacker, if there's glory in that. You see, it doesn't matter that you have laws. The key is you have to have laws, you have to have constraints, you have to have rules that fit your nature. You see, in the Bible, freedom is not just constraint from law, but it's also not just conformity to law. It's conformity to the right law. It's liberating restrictions. So the psalmist here, he's not just seeking any law, he's seeking God's law, because he understands that God's law creates the context for human flourishing, because God's law fits our human nature. You see, God's law, the law contained in God's word, is not stifling, it's liberating. Think of it this way. This is the example. I've used it before many times. I use it in my catechism classes all the time. You take a fish. Don't take the fish. You find the fish. Where do you find him? You find him in the water. And when you observe the fish in the water, what is he doing? He's swimming all over the place. Maybe he jumps out and breaks water and dives back in. He swims around rocks and he swims upstream and he swims downstream. He's free. He can go wherever he wants. And you look at that poor fish and you say, "Ah, that poor fish, constrained by the water, ruled by this law known as water." And you take the fish and you're going to liberate him from the water. And you're going to say, "You know what? There's a whole other realm of reality you haven't experienced, fish. There's a whole other side to this glorious world. We call it land. Here, fish, enjoy the freedom of the land." And you toss him out onto the grass. And he flops around. Can you get that on the MP3? And you pick him up, and you gently put him back in the water. And his strength returns, and he's off again. Because the fish was built for the water. God says, "Listen, I built the human heart. I built you. I knit you together in your mother's womb. I know you better than you know yourself. And my law makes you flourish like the musician. You practice your scales, and you will fly as a musician." Verse 37 says, "Turn my eyes from worthless things. Preserve my life according to your word." Verse 40, again, how I long for your precepts. Preserve my life in your righteousness. Twice again we hear this. Preserving of life is connected to the law of God. In other words, God's law, God's way is life. If you look at the little note in verse 37, it says, "Preserve my life according to your word." There's a little A, and you look back down at the bottom, and it says, most manuscripts of the Masoretic texts say, "Life in your way." God's law is a way of life. Preserve my life in your way. God's way is the way of life. That's the point. Look, physical laws govern the physical universe. There are spiritual laws that govern the spiritual universe as well. And so, there are consequences for both. Remember earlier I said, if you say that you are going to do as you please in the physical universe, you don't care what the laws of the physical universe are, God doesn't have to punish you for breaking those laws. You'll experience the consequences of breaking those laws. So you go up on the top of the church and you say, "I'm going to fly," and you jump off and gravity kicks in like it always does, and you break your legs. Doesn't matter what you say you're going to do, if you don't conform yourself to God's law, he doesn't have to come after you and hit you with a thunderbolt or a lightning bolt and punish you for it. You will experience the punishment of breaking his law when the law breaks you. And the same, my friends, is true in the spiritual world. So when people say, you know, God has all these laws about sexual purity, well, I am going to decide for myself what is sexually permissible and not, and you decide that you're going to lead a sexually immoral life, or perhaps you commit adultery, or perhaps you sleep with your girlfriend before you get married, and then you never get married, and so you've got multiple partners, and you say, "I'm going to live this way anyway." God is not going to come with you with the lightning bolt and hit you. You'll face the consequences of it. You'll see broken relationships. You'll see distance and isolation created between you and the person that you say you have a relationship with because you have not committed to them to the degree that the Bible calls you to commit to them financially, socially, psychologically, and emotionally before you commit to them physically. And you will never be able to experience the intimacy of the relationship that God has designed it to be. It's not because God is standing up in heaven punishing you for the sins that you have committed. It's because the law, you're not conforming yourself to the reality that exists. It's there, whether you like it or not. Listen, if God was going to punish you or punish me for the sins that I committed, if he watched Paul Vanderbreak go about his business over the course of a day, and at the end of the day, added him up and said, okay, I better punish him for the sins he committed today, I'd be obliterated already, friends. And so would you be. God's law is there when you keep them to enable you to flourish. To experience human existence as God had designed it to be experienced. That's what it's there for. Finally, last thing. Look at verse 35 and verse 39. Interesting. He says, direct me in the paths of your commands, for there I find delight. That's verse 35. 39, take away the verse 40, how I long for your precepts. So he talks about delighting in verse 35. Delighting in God's law. In verse 40, he talks about how he longs for God's precepts. This is the language of love. One commentator said that verse 40 is essentially what he's saying is he is lovesick for the law of God. You could almost say he's love drunk for the law of God. It's the language of love. And the reason that this language is being used is because love is the greatest liberating constraint, liberating restriction of them all. He loves God's law. He longs for God's law. He pines for God's law. He wants to understand it. He meditates on it to think out the implications of it. And then when he gets up in the morning, he plots out his life in such a way that he will conform to it. Why? Because he loves it. Because he lusts after it. Because he is desirous of it. Because it is the most liberating restriction of them all. What in the world do I mean by that? Well, lots of you have been in relationships and are in relationships right now. And the one thing I'm sure that you know that if you want to experience joy, if you want to experience flourishing, if you want happiness in your relationship, husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, these kinds of things, if you want to feel that, if you want to know that, the very first thing you have to do is you have to give up autonomy. It's the first rule. The first thing you do is you constrain yourself. You restrain yourself. All of a sudden, you're accountable to someone else. You have to limit yourself. You can't just come and go as you please. I learned this the hard way. You know, I started dating this great girl who I want to marry. I'm supposed to be home at 10. I went out instead, came home at 11:30. I thought someone had died. And I almost did. Because I didn't call first. I was worried about you. I was concerned. Because I was now accountable to another person. I couldn't just do whatever I wanted. I had responsibilities towards someone else. But here's the thing, that as the relationship grows, the strange thing is that you never feel more free, you never feel more alive than when you feel deeply loved. Come on. You know that deep down in your soul. You've known that. Some of you have known it for a long time. Don't ever take it for granted. Some of you have tasted it for fleeting moments, and you long for it more and more and more. When you conform yourself to the law of your lover, it does not feel like a burden. It's a release. And what God is calling us to do is not submit ourselves to his law as though it were a burden, but out of love. Now, some of you, perhaps, let me just say this. Some of you, perhaps, find that scary. And the reason you find that scary is because you have done something like that with someone before. You have submitted yourself to someone else out of love. And they abused that. And they hurt you. And you say to yourself, listen, I'm not getting burned again. Some of you may not even be able to articulate that in relationship to God, but that's how it works. If you were to sit in a quiet place and mull over and turn over how you understand God, you would find that you have been shaped by your past experiences, and now you have a very hard time understanding that if you would just truly let go of all your autonomy and not worry about defending yourself before the King of the universe, that terrifies you because you've done it before, and you got burned terribly by it. Here's the difference. With God, it's different because God did it first. In Jesus Christ, God came down and he voluntarily limited himself and became like us. This is the God of the universe. This is Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, who constrained himself to the point that when he had to deal, yeah, he worked wonderful miracles, but when he had to do it, what did he always have to do? He had to call on his Father. He had to live by faith. He had to seek power through him because he had limited himself. Philippians chapter 2 says, Jesus Christ, oh man, I used to have this memorized better, says, Philippians chapter 2 says, he who being in very nature God did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant being made in human likeness. You see, he limited himself first. And not only did he limit himself first, friends, he was treated like you and me. He was treated like a sinner for us. 2 Corinthians 5 says most profoundly, or 10, sorry, 2 Corinthians 10 says most profoundly, he who knew no sin became sin for us. Does that mean that Jesus became a sinner, like that he committed sins? No. You're not perfect like Jesus, but God treats you like you're perfect like Jesus. In the same way, he wasn't imperfect like us, but God treated him like he was imperfect like us. Why? So that we might be the righteousness of God. He did it first. He loved you first. He limited himself first. He constrained himself first. He said, I will walk the road to Calvary first. I will experience the depths of hell itself first. I will be cast off by the Father first so that I can make you mine and so that you can know when you look at the cross and you wonder, is he for me or is he against me? You hear it bellowed back to you loud and clear. I am for you. My love will never, ever, ever abuse you. Because you are so precious to me that it took nothing short of the spilt blood of my own perfect Son to make you mine. Do not be afraid of him. He is like no friend, no father, no lover that you can know on this earth. He is perfect. And he is indeed safe. Let's pray. Father, we